Call the House Judiciary Committee to order.
We need five or six.
April 28th, Thursday, we're going to skip down because Senator Pomaski is here. Would you come up, please, and open a hearing on Senate Bill 635?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senate Bill 635A would add a couple additional exceptions to the general standing private security professional certification requirement located at ORS 181871. These two would be, first of all, persons who provide security services as volunteers for an event operated for the benefit of a not-for-profit corporation, and secondly, students who are enrolled at community colleges who are engaged in non-confrontational activities that contribute to campus safety under the supervision of a law enforcement or private security professional.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and committee members. Floyd Przanski, State Senator, District 4, representing parts of Lane and Douglas counties. I want to thank the committee for taking up Senate Bill 635. It does have a couple of fixes, as Council has stated, as to what we're attempting to do. Really, the first part is clarification regarding when a organization would be required to have private security professionals certified to meet the definitions when they're providing security services. Specifically, when you have nonprofit organizations that provide their own security for their own event, there was a lack of clarification in the statute as to whether it did or didn't apply to those nonprofit organizations. In discussions and working with DPSST, and to my right is Teresa Nagel, and Teresa is the program manager in the area of the private security investigations. We had a conversation that they were interpreting based on what a previous assistant attorney general had stated that they, under their opinion, what was required or not required. After we had our discussion, there was another review by the attorney general's office, and they came away with yes, that nonprofit organizations were not required to have their volunteers go through this process. So to make certain that it's clear in the statute, we're asking that be added into the exemptions. You will see in the statutes already where there is a list of exemptions. This could, in fact, if it were under the first interpretation, impact many volunteer organizations, such as the Roundup, that does, in fact, use a lot of their own volunteer citizens that participate in this process. That's why a co-sponsor is Senator Nelson. And we also realized that literally, if you took the interpretation that was being put forth, if you had even at any of the type of events, such as a wedding at a church, where they were monitoring who was coming into the church for the wedding, that they could, in fact, also be included. So this is really to just set the record straight, and we wanted to make certain that that took place and was able to clear to all of those who are in this arena, the nonprofits, that they do not have to have private security professionals from their volunteers in the sense of going through that process. While we were hearing that bill in the Senate, it came to our attention regarding an issue regarding campus policing and the efforts and using student volunteers. This is one that, after discussion, we wanted to ensure that, again, that if you had individual students who are enrolled in community colleges that were working what we call non-confrontational activities, and the best example I can give you is like a Lane Community College. The new director of security there has in the past, in his previous employment, used individuals that were students that were volunteering and or and sometimes receiving some type of stipend that would be basically just walking through campus. If they saw something that was unusual that needed to have response, they would just call in to the center to say, "I'm your eyes. I see this happening. You need to bring someone out here." They did not actually confront anyone, but because of the lack of clarity as it pertains to the community colleges, they would in fact be required to go through that training. As compared to at the university system, they were not required to do so because they were captured in the current definition.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Teresa Nagel. I am the private Security Private Investigator Manager at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, otherwise known as DPSST. DPSST regulates private security providers and private investigators based on statutory authority and regulations that were established in 1995. Our investigators have attended events in which volunteers were providing security services and were receiving some type of consideration for these services. Because our governing statutes define in part that anyone performing security services for consideration need to be certified or licensed, it did lead to some confusion as to who we were supposed to regulate. This confusion occurred not only internally, but also with members of the industry. We would occasionally receive complaints about these individuals providing these services as uncertified individuals. Senate Bill 635A helps to clarify the original intent of the Private Security Services Providers Act and exempts volunteers who provide services for nonprofit organizations and receive this de minimis consideration. As amended in the Senate, Senate Bill 635A also adds to the list of exemptions students who are attending the community colleges who perform these non-confrontational security activities while they're on their campus and under the supervision of either a certified law enforcement officer or a certified or licensed private security provider. DPSST has worked with the proponents of the bill and the amendments to address our early technical concerns with the language. There are no fiscal impacts, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Committee members, any questions?
Mr. Chair, I apologize for being late, and maybe this was already answered, but I'm wondering why only community colleges and not colleges and universities?
Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Tomei, the university system students are already captured in another part of the statutes, and so they are already, let's say, exempted or included. The reason we are putting this in is to ensure that and, let's say, extend it down to the community college level.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Was that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, thank you. I think this is great. I noticed they're receiving de minimis consideration. We had a situation, I think it was last session or session before, when Representative Burling and I, we did some legislation so people volunteer to ski but get benefits don't have to pay taxes on that.
Put your mic around.
I apologize. Does this address that, or did you thought about that issue as far as what are you talking about for consideration?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Whitsnett, the situation you're describing as to what you addressed and does not really apply to the situations we're talking about. These are situations where individuals may receive some type of a T-shirt, a cap, or food while they're performing these tasks. They're not actually exchanging money for that service. They are truly volunteers, and they're just, it's kind of like you want to accommodate the volunteers, make sure they have food or drink. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have had that issue that my friend here referred to several sessions in our own business and labor, and I think it's anything of value of $50 or less a quarter is allowable, so I hope I don't want this coming back. Where they have to pay unemployment insurance or whatever taxes. I just don't want to see that because it's not a fun experience to have. And then where people just come out of the woodwork wanting exceptions, exclusions, and it's just not a fun part of this statute to tear into. So I hope it's less than $50 a quarter, whatever their T-shirt they're getting. Thank you, though.
Representative Nolan, you look like you're wanting to.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate the invitation. The concern I have is that zero is a bright line. De minimis is not a bright line. $50 is a bright line. And I just want assurances from somebody that there is a bright line so that we don't get into having to arbitrate what de minimis means.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Nolan. This was an issue and a discussion we had on the Senate side, and the term de minimis is actually one a term of art, one that is actually used in the statutes, and one that was actually brought forward by, if I'm not mistaken, the Attorney General, Assistant Attorney General, who was advising DPSST, as well as attorney for one of the nonprofits, as the framework they would use. And so that's pretty much it.
Further committee? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 635. We're going to go to Senate Bill 373 and open the public hearing. Greg Prince, you want to come up, please? We're going to give you a couple minutes.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Bill 373 would direct Forfeiture Counsel to file all records of criminal forfeiture with the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee electronically in accordance with rules that would be promulgated for that purpose. This would remove the obligation of Forfeiture Counsel to provide the AFOAC with a copy of such forfeiture judgment physically.
Thank you, co-chairs. Thank you, council, members of the committee. I'm Craig Prinz on Senate Bill 373. My staff's the Forfeiture Oversight Committee. Representative Olson's the co-chair with Senator Przanski. This is a committee that just monitors forfeitures, writes a report, letting you all know how much is being forfeited, what is happening with the dollars. My staff moved to an electronic way to get those reports in. It's more efficient. This allows that to be done without any questions of having anyone still doing the paper reporting. So that's what this does. I do have a technical amendment that I've asked council to draft that I'm having Rob Bavette, who's on the committee with Representative Olson and Senator Przanski, to clarify when the electronic report would need to be submitted. So we have that clarified. And so that's what this does. It just streamlines the reporting of forfeitures so it's done electronically. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Committee? Representative Hicks?
Is this going to work under eCourt?
Co-chairs, Representative Hicks. It will. I think we already set it up. We've got it. We so it should work. I can talk to Dave Factor and about how it will go. But I think it would work real well together with it.
Okay.
Anything further, committee? Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 373. We're going to go back up to 409. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 409.
Co-chairs, members of the committee. Senate Bill 409 would require a judge sitting in an aggravated murder trial to appoint a stenographic reporter for all phases of that trial.
We have 13 people, I believe, signed up, so I'll give you about four to five minutes each. Marsha, is it Nageli? Nageli?
Yes,
Nageli. Come up, Brad Fulton and Richard Hunt. That was the ones that were signed up in that order, if you want to come up together. Identify yourselves and start in any order you want.
My name is Marcia Nagley, and I am the owner of Nagley Reporting Corporation, Court Reporters International, and Nagley Trial Technology. What we've got here is a bill that is a solution in search of a problem. It is limiting to just one method of technology for the aggravated murder. The state of Oregon, approximately 10 years ago, had the foresight to put in all digital reporting or electronic recording for their hearings. And I might add that about 8 years ago, the Senate and House of the legislature system removed the stenograph reporter and went to recording. And it's working great, and there have been no problems. The grand jury has now gone to all recording in all grand juries throughout Oregon. There has not been one transcript in all the courtrooms throughout Oregon that has had to be redone because of an equipment failure on an aggravated murder case since the Judicial Department installed electronic recording system in around 2000. The state has saved millions since the Judicial Department installed the recording system. This would be a giant step backwards, and the state will have to budget money when in a financial crisis like never before. Stenographers, and I'm a stenographer, are not more accurate than a recording. The recording gives you the actual testimony, not the court reporter's interpretation of the proceeding. And I have to say, I'm a trained stenographer. I'm not against stenographic reporting. And it's been a challenge for me to adjust to the different technologies coming into our industry. But what I've had to do is accept that. It's the 21st century. There's all kinds of great technology. There's videotaping of testimony. There's audio recording. There's voice recognition. There's stenographic. It's kind of like I could take a train to Seattle, a plane to Seattle, or drive my car to Seattle. They all get me to Seattle. 70% of the courtrooms in the United States use digital recording. The court reporting industry is headed in that direction, and it's growing exponentially. Eventually, 100% of all courtrooms will use it. The stenographers have fought any new technology for years. We believe the bill is a solution in search of a problem, and the proponent of this bill has not brought forth any cases in Oregon where the equipment has truly failed, caused a trial to have to be redone. And please realize, too, no matter what method you use, whether it's voice writing or stenographic, there's sometimes mistakes in the transcript. Sometimes even stenographers drop the testimony. Trials are very costly. There's been a number given of $89,000. I can assure you, and I've got the facts here, that the case of Joshua Turnage aggravated murder trial went from 9-8-2010 clear through December 8th of 2010. And that's not all the hearings and motions and all the other items that are needed in a trial. And that would be anywhere from $6,000 to $8,000 a week to have a stenographer. So that one alone would be around $70,000 to $90,000 for that one trial. This bill unfairly promotes only one method of reporting proceedings. This bill was brought by a few of the stenographic reporters, and it is more of a protection bill than anything else. And it's just like the newspapers. I mean, if the newspapers could have kept the internet from publicizing the newspapers, they would have done it. And should an attorney or a judge want a stenographer or a voice writer or any other methodology, they're free to put it in right now. It doesn't have to be mandated. The United States Supreme Court uses 100% electronic recording. If it's good enough for them, it should be good enough for our state. And then February 6th, it's just been published. On February 6th, the Judicial Committee for Minnesota has recommended that to cut costs, the Minnesota Judicial Council replace all court reporters with digital audio recording. And then a couple other comments, and then I'm finished, is that there is numerous national associations. There's the Court Reporter Association for Stenographic Reporting. There's a Court Reporting Association called ERT for Electronic Reporting. There's a Court Reporting Association for Voice Recognition. There's all kinds of associations. And the one for stenographic is aware of the problems. And they have published many, many articles, which I have, giving arguments to fight help us fight or help the stenographers fight any new technology. Here's a quote. Fueling this change of heart is the realization that, like it or not, in many states and court systems, digital audio recording is an established reality that is not going away. And the president of the Stenographic Reporting Association, I quote, it says, if you have courts that are considering the benefits of digital audio, it's a tough fight. When your decision makers realize that a steno reporter costs the state $80,000 and they can install digital for $20,000 and it will last for 5 years, which decision do you think they are going to make? Andrew Trina said, how can you possibly say that what the human ear interprets is better than what is being recorded electronically? And the president of the Stenographic Association stated, we realized we were not going to be able to stop technology of any kind. And so we have to learn to embrace the technology. One of my last quotes is, the president of the Stenographic Reporting Association said, official reporters can no longer ignore electronic recording in the hope that it somehow won't affect them. So it's really about all the methods. They all work. Of course, if electronic, if you don't have the clerk turn it on, it's not going to work. Just like if the stenographic reporter doesn't get enough sleep, he or she is not going to be able to report accurately. The digital, one of the pro statements is, there's a lot of the judges that want to hear the actual voices of the witnesses rather than read a transcript. Digital audio systems now offer features such as ambient sound detection that can begin to record once voices start speaking, eliminating the most common failure of electronic systems, which is when a clerk fails to turn it on. So one person, Dave Markowitz, he is the founder of the Markowitz Herbold and Glade firm. He was sorry he couldn't be here to testify today. He's adamantly against Senate Bill 409. He was selected as one of Portland's 2010 Litigator of the Year, and he is also selected as one of the top 10 Oregon litigators by the National Law Journal, and he's in the fellow of International Academy of Trial Lawyers. He wanted me to mention that he is absolutely against Senate Bill 409, as is Don Marmaduke. I brought stacks of letters from lawyers, court reporters, organizations that see this as nothing more than a way to limit competition. And so I just ask you, please, do not vote for this bill. Thank you.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Brad Fulton. I'm an Oregon licensed trial attorney. I'm well versed in the court reporting field. I have done work with court reporting firms in the past and worked on other court reporting issues aside from this one as well. More importantly, as a practicing attorney, I'm a consumer of court reporting services. And I join Ms. Negley in opposing adamantly passage of 409. I also agree that it is a solution looking for a problem. From where I sit, I see nothing in this bill that will improve justice. And that's really what the system is intended for, especially in the cases that this bill addresses. And more importantly, the alleged solution is going to be a very, very expensive one. And in the worst fiscal crisis that any of us have probably ever lived through, this is a really bad idea for that reason as well. Electronic recording, as Ms. Negley said, has worked very well for the last decade. The days of paying stenographers to sit through breaks in court, motions that aren't recorded, all of the downtime during trials, they are very expensive, and every down minute is a minute that you're paying them to be there while they're doing nothing. Electronic equipment doesn't charge for downtime, and so that is where the savings are and why millions have been saved over the years. This bill, quite honestly, is proposed by stenographers for the benefit of stenographers. And I almost hate to say that to you, but it's true. And in this climate, I think we really need to ask ourselves, is it a good idea for the legislature to tell the courts how to spend their money when they're already overburdened, they're already underfunded? And I think that's something we really need to think about in terms of separation of powers. Should the courts decide, or should the legislature decide, how best to allocate the limited funds they have for these types of services? Again, based on what I know, no case has been overturned, no transcript has had to be redone in an aggravated murder trial, and frankly, electronic recording does take the human error aspect out of the area here. And so stenographers make mistakes. I've seen it. I think every attorney's seen it. The electronic recording does not lie. It does not make mistakes. It's there to be heard. And there are backup systems that can be implemented. So this really is a very expensive solution to a problem that I simply do not feel exists. I think this is a, we need to think about, is this a good idea for the masses, for the public, and the good use of their tax dollars, or is it a good idea for the stenographers who have proposed it? Mm-hmm. So I urge you to vote in favor of advanced and more accurate technology, the electronic recording. I urge you to vote in favor of sound fiscal considerations. I urge you to vote in favor of allowing the courts and not court reporters or stenographers to decide how their money is best spent to render justice in these cases. And finally, I would urge you to vote against self-serving legislation proposed by these stenographers. So please vote no on 409. Thank you.
Co-chairs and committee members, my name is Richard Hunt. I'm a partner at Baron Liebman. I've been practicing in Oregon for well over 30 years, and during that time period I've watched the change in methods by which proceedings and trials are reported, and I think the changes have been for the positive in that they have been cost-saving measures. They have reduced the need to always have a stenographic reporter present. So I am opposed to Senate Bill 409. I would also point out that although there are many stenographic reporters here today, and I've even used some of them, and some of them are fine stenographic reporters, not all stenographic reporters are created equal. They can make mistakes. Unfortunately, in the last month, I personally have witnessed stenographic reporters being incapable of reading back questions that were asked and had to defer to the audio backup. So to select just a single method by which this type of proceeding can be reported is not a wise decision. My partner, Ed Harnden, is a former president of the Oregon Bar, and Ed has been involved for years in the campaign for equal justice and other measures to ensure smooth and efficient operation of the judicial system. And one of the serious issues facing the Oregon judicial system today is the simple fact that there's not enough money, funding, to deal with the problems that it has. It's got many pressing problems, not enough funding, ranging from judicial compensation to keeping the courts functioning 5 days a week. And if you're going to impose a mandatory system of stenographic reporting, then that's just going to raise the cost and take away from other vital important needs of the judicial system, as well as other things that the state needs to fund. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Tomei?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So I guess I have a question to the staff. We keep hearing about the cost of this. Why wasn't this sent to Ways and Means?
Co-chairs, Representative Tomei, an indeterminate fiscal impact statement was associated with this bill as it was formally issued by fiscal. The reasons for that being that the number of aggravated murder trials from year to year vary so dramatically that it was difficult for them to come up with any sense of how much it would cost. I think ultimately they might be able to come up with a per trial determination that you have years where there are 5 ag murders, you have years where there are 11 ag murders. It's just very difficult to predict. And that's, I could quote more directly from their statement if you'd like.
I would like a copy of the statement. It seems to me what we're talking about is there are, you're implying that there are between 5 and 11 aggravated murder cases a year. So I would assume, we're hearing that there's a great deal of expense that goes with this, that it seems to me it would have been appropriate to have been sent to Ways and Means.
It has a subsequent
It does have a subsequent referral?
It has a subsequent referral.
I see that. Thank you.
Representative Juan.
Thank you, Mr. Bellmeister.
No, I didn't do that.
So Baron Liebman is an employment law firm that tries a lot of cases in the federal courthouse. Is that right?
Federal and state courthouse.
And follow up. So would you please, could you compare for us the quality of the audio recording equipment in the federal courthouse downtown with the quality of the audio recording equipment in the nearly century old circuit court on 4th?
I can't make that comparison, although I suspect that it is superior in the federal court because they have a much greater funding capacity than the state courts. But the issue still remains whether a stenographic reporter is the only method that should be used.
Follow up. Thank you. And this bill doesn't impact your firm's practice area at all.
Well,
is that right?
The concern is that if this window is open, then we're going to go back in time, and over time we're going to see other proceedings that formerly used to use stenographic reporters. This is just the first bill, and who knows what's going to happen next session.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Can you testify to us today that over the course of your practice using the recordings, that you've never received a transcript on an appeal with large or even small sections where the transcriptionist was unable, due to the quality of the recording, to accurately report what was said in that courtroom? Can you say that's never happened in your practice?
I can't say that.
It's common occurrence.
Well,
right?
I'm not going to say that either. I will tell you that I'm amazed at the number of times that I have had issues with stenographic reporters. That isn't to say that issues arise with other forms of reporting as well, but it happens. It happened to me within the last 2 months.
One last one, Mr. Co-Vice Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. Can you think of any type of a court case that is more important to society than an aggravated murder case?
That is to be left for the... That's a matter of subjective opinion. I think all of cases that I'm involved in are important ones, but I understand your point. That certainly is a significant type of case.
Now, just make a comment. I don't think there is anything that we do in the judicial department that is more important than an aggravated murder case where the defendant is on trial subject to the death penalty, period. That is it. I don't care how many millions or billions of dollars are at stake. That is the number one type of case. And that's the type of case that this bill is exclusively aimed at. So thank you for your indulgence.
Further questions? Okay, thank you, panel. We'll call Sue Roberts, Susan Miller, and Yvette Winder or Winden?
Winden.
You can go any order you like.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, I am Susan Miller of Business Support Services. I have been in the electronic reporting industry for over 29 years. Business Support Services was one of the first electronic recording companies in the state of Oregon. We have assisted many of the state agencies with their development of in-house electronic equipment. And I see no reasonable basis to the preclusion of electronic recordings of any court procedure, state or federal. I believe Senate Bill 409 unfairly promotes only one method of reporting. There are a number of other forms of technology to accurately record and transcribe proceedings, not just one. The state of Oregon has already invested in various electronic recording systems, which have proven to be both reliable and cost-effective. In these times of tight budgets, it is unreasonable to ask the taxpayer of Oregon to pay a premium price for one specific service when there is a viable and cost-effective system already in place. If Senate Bill 409 passes, it will be a giant step backward, and the state will have to find additional dollars to fund this at a time when the state agencies and programs must cut their budgets. I see this as an anti-competitive move. Electronic recording captures the actual testimony, not interpretations of the proceedings. If there is ever a question regarding what was said, the questioning party can listen to the recording and can hear exactly what was said and how it was said. Approximately 70% of our courtrooms in the United States use electronic recording, and eventually electronic recording will be used in every courtroom. One of the most valuable contributions electronic reporting can make is when a witness requires an interpreter. This is increasingly important as the numbers of people in America who speak English as a second language is growing, and who are more comfortable testifying under oath in their native tongue. Electronic reporting can capture both the original language being spoken as well as its English translation. So questions related to whether an interpretation was correctly rendered in court can be resolved. Technology is advancing in our courts, so much so that the United States Supreme Court uses electronic reporting exclusively to capture and preserve its historic public record. It is 100% accurate and does not rely on personal interpretations of what is said. If you proceed with Senate Bill 409, you will unnecessarily be wasting substantial sums of taxpayer dollars which are urgently needed elsewhere. Thank you.
Good afternoon, co-chair and committee members. My name is Yvette Winden, and I'm a court reporter. I just want to add a couple things. I think many of the points have already been touched on. But I would like to say that electronic recording, first of all, works. It's been in the courtrooms now for 10 years, a decade, and we don't have any issues. It saves the state millions of dollars, and as a taxpayer, that affects me. As a court reporter, this bill is aimed at limiting my work. Currently, I can transcribe court reporting proceedings or trial proceedings from the audio recording. This bill limits that by requiring not just a court reporter, but a certified court reporter. Oregon is not a mandatory certification state, and the passing of this bill would require me to have a certification and to pass an exam, even though I've been court reporting for many, many years. I will also say that the recording gives you a better and more accurate transcript. Again, doesn't just rely on the court reporter's interpretation. I want to add also that for these aggravated murder trials, because they are so important, we have seen in other states that the judges on their own and not mandated by the legislature can hire a court reporter if they so choose. But it's not mandated by the legislature. It is their choice, and they can do that if they want to, as an added feature, not just the recording. And as the last thing, I'd just like to say, the money that would have to be budgeted for the court reporters for the aggravated murder trials could be and would be better spent improving the technology that is already in the courthouses by giving you a better audio recording, because that's where the industry is headed, not backwards 10 years to the stenographic reporting method. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? All right, thank you both.
Thank you.
Elijah Michael Michaela something.
Michalowski.
Catherine Teach and Carol Steinman. Studeman.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Elijah Michalowski. I'm a deputy district attorney in Lincoln County. I'm also here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And I think the first thing I want to point out is there's just been, what I'm hearing are some, what I would classify as some troubling assumptions about what this bill does. The first is that this bill would somehow replace electronic reporting in aggravated murder trials. And it doesn't do that. The courtrooms still have that equipment. They still can turn on the equipment. And the fact it's not a either-or proposition. And what this bill does is it requires stenographic reporters, as it does not require the judges to not turn on or the clerks to not turn on the systems that they already have. And so it actually increases accuracy because now you have two systems. You have the stenographic reporter, but you also, if there's an issue that arises with that and some thought that maybe something is incorrect there, you can go back and you can compare it to the recorded record. So that's the first troubling issue, I would say, troubling assumption. The second troubling assumption and that I've heard is that and electronic reporting is somehow infallible. And I can tell you, and anybody who's ever read a court transcript that's been transcribed from from electronic recording, and can tell you that there will be sections in that recording that just say indistinguishable. Anybody who's ever listened to a electronic recording and will tell you that there are times when you have difficulty figuring out what is said. The reasons for that are many. The microphones are often in stationary positions. People move around in the courtrooms. There can be interference from other electronic devices, cell phones, whatever. So electronic reporting is a good system. We fully support electronic recording, and it's used in the vast majority of the cases. And the third, troubling assumption that I've heard is that this would somehow have these lasting and huge effects on the judiciary system beyond aggravated murder trials. This bill specifically speaks only to aggravated murder. As Representative Juan pointed out, and we would agree with him, and these are the absolute most important most important thing that we do in the judicial system is aggravated murder trials. This bill speaks only to that. We've got a limited number. There is a cost. I can't give you a number today. We've had some discussion about that already. There is a cost, and that has to be taken into consideration like anything else that does cost. But it's minimal, and the effects, there's nothing here that should bleed over into the practice of civil law. There's nothing here that would bleed over into any other criminal case. It would only be aggravated murder cases. The stenographic reporting, and we at ODAA believe that it is the most accurate form. As I mentioned, there are problems with the electronic. It's good. It's just not perfect. We believe stenographic by a certified professional stenographic reporter is the most accurate. It also allows for more instant recall, and it allows you to go back. You know, these trials take time. They take a lot of time, and they can be spread out over many, many, many months sometimes. And the ability to have a stenographic report and go back, it can accurately look at what was testified earlier in a trial, a ruling that the judge made earlier in the trial, is paramount in cases of this importance. And then finally, and I've kind of mentioned on this, this creates a backup system. Right now, what you have with solely electronic recording is if there is a problem, and maybe we haven't had that problem yet in Oregon on a aggravated murder case, but this isn't the type of thing that we want to wait until we have a problem with there being a record that's unclear. This is something we want to be proactive about. And by having a stenographic report and having the electronic there as a backup, you ensure the most accuracy, you ensure that you don't have those problems moving forward. That's all my prepared remarks. I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay, we'll wait for questions and tell the end of the panel. Go ahead, please.
Okay. Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Catherine Teach, president of the Oregon Court Reporters Association, and I am also president of a court reporting agency in Portland. With me today is Carol Studeman, chair of the Legislative Committee, and also Karen Eichhorn, member of the Legislative Committee, and they will be also speaking on behalf of Senate Bill 409. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. As you know, Senate Bill 409 would provide a certified court reporter to be the official record in aggravated murder trials. We are not asking for anything more than for the aggravated murder trials. As an officer and guardian of the record, a certified court reporter in the courtroom would provide the most up-to-date technology to ensure an accurate written record of proceedings, thereby protecting the fundamental rights and interests of the citizens of the state of Oregon. We are, as court reporters, impartial guardians of the record, and we place high value on the accuracy, impartiality, and confidentiality of the record. Certified reporters are required to maintain continuing education credits each year. The transcribers that transcribe these audio digital recordings are not required to do that. There have been instances where they do not know the legal terminology and put in little guesses as to what they are. The Chief Justice put this policy option package into place in the last session. Under the pilot program, the State Court Administrator's Office will pay for the reporter's travel-related and time expenses. The parties would pay for the transcript costs. Contract court reporters would be used through a competitive bid process, using the lowest cost qualified services available. At a minimum, all reporters working on a trial would be required and have to maintain their current Oregon certification as a certified shorthand reporter. And I think that is one of the most important things, is that we have somebody that's qualified to do this. It is often that it's not often that prosecutors and defense attorneys are of similar mind, but on this bill they are. We have plenty of people that are going to be testifying along with me at this table right here. And I also wanted to mention that the court reporters, Representative Wand or the federal court, does use court reporters right now. They use audio recording for very, very few motions once in a while. And the United States Attorney's Office in Portland just entered into another 5-year contract to have court reporters provide to be in the grand jury reporting. I think along that line, Multnomah County has asked to use Judge Wilson's court reporters. Judge Wilson is hearing impaired, so she has two court reporters that provide real-time reporting for her. They have been asking those reporters to go in to the to do grand jury in Multnomah County so they can have accurate written records. They also hired one pro tem, and I believe it was the Boy Scout trial or the Boy Scout grand jury hearings. They actually hired an outside court reporter to do that. And then in 2 days ago, on April 26th, in California, the court reporters were going to be, there was a bill to replace the court reporters down there, and that was defeated. California has one of the largest court reporting or the largest systems in the United States, and they also decided that it was worth it to keep court reporters in the courtroom even with the horrendous budget problems that they have down there. Every Oregon should support this bill as it benefits not only the prosecutors, defense attorneys, and the defendants, but also the victims and their families who are relying on fair, effective, and efficient justice from the court system. Please vote yes on Senate Bill 409. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, I'm Carol Studenman, and I'm from Portland. I'm an owner of a court reporting agency and the legislative chairperson for the Oregon Court Reporters Association. As you know, in 2002, almost all of the court reporters were laid off. Marion County retains one court reporter. Lane County has four. And as Ms. Teach said, Multnomah County has one as an accommodation for a judge with hearing loss. The electronic systems are in, and money has been saved, and, you know, we understand that. In 2004, a work group was put together with the state court administrator. It was chaired by Representative Walker, and court reporters were involved and attorneys. And out of that work group, this bill came forward in terms of having court reporters for aggravated murder trials. So this is not just something the court reporters have dreamed up and thought of as something we'd like to do on our own. I'd like to compare two capital cases that have occurred recently in Oregon. You may have read about them in the paper, but the Randy Guzik case was heard in Bend for the fourth time, I guess, last year. The case ended on June 17th. It was reported electronically. A court reporter wasn't asked to transcribe the CDs from that case until August, so they lost some time there. About 6,000 pages of transcript were generated, and the transcriber is still working on that. In September, the Turnage case was started here in Marion County. Marion County used their live court reporter, Mary Fagan, who's one of our members of our association, and she's working on an aggravated murder case as we speak today. Otherwise, she'd be here with us. She reported over 10,000 pages of transcript in that trial. She's already got half of it filed with the court for the appeals process. During that trial, she was able to provide the attorneys with real-time daily rough ASCIIs. At the end of the day, she would give them a file of what she'd written that day. They could take that file and use it. They didn't have to wait until 2 months after the trial ended for that process to even begin. They were getting those transcripts daily. That saved the attorneys time. I'm sure you understand the state pays for the criminal defense on a capital case most often. So that saves the state money for those people to be working more effectively. That just travels all the way down the line, up the line, I guess, if you're headed for the Supreme Court. For the appeals process through the Supreme Court, everyone works more efficiently with this type of transcript, and that saves money. We don't just want to do this because it's fun for us, but we think that it shouldn't depend on what part of the state you live in, whether you get to have a trial with a live reporter or have to depend on electronic reporting. That doesn't seem very fair. And this would allow, you know, the people involved with that Guzik case in Bend to have had a live reporter. That impacts the family. The longer the case takes, I mean, that's a pretty extraordinary case. I guess it's the fourth time it was tried. The longer it takes, it just piles up on the families of the victims. We humbly request that you support this. We know that you all have terrible decisions to face this term. This is not something that is just, you know, we aren't just doing this to pass the time. We know you have terrible decisions, but we think this will help you save money in the long run, and that's why we ask for you to support this. Thank you for your time, and I'm open to any questions.
Representative Tillman, did you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Elijah, I'm sorry, I can't remember your last name.
Mike Lowski.
So, right now, a judge, if he or she is going to be at a court trial, they can request a court stenographer, right?
They can. There's a question of how is that going to get paid for, and if you've got a system where it's done ad hoc, then you're going to have extraordinary circumstances. That judge is going to have to explain, to the Judicial Department why he wants that extra money for that particular trial, he or she.
Follow-up? That is a judgment the judge could make, correct?
It's my understanding that that's correct, yes.
So, follow-up? So why wouldn't a judge do that?
That's a good question. I'm not a judge. I'm not in the head, in the mind of judges. I don't know what the answer to that is, Representative Tomei.
Okay, thank you. Maybe one last one. So can either the defense lawyer or the prosecuting attorney ask for that?
Well, sure, we could ask for it. There's no specific authorization, but you know, when there are issues that come up in a trial, we can ask for the court to address them in certain ways, and that's something that would be something that either a prosecutor or a defense attorney could ask for. But in the current situation, there's no setup mechanism to do that. There's no requirement to do that. I fear that getting the one-time approval of the money would be what would probably kill it in most cases.
Committee staff has some guidance for us, I think.
Good.
Thank you, Co-Chair Garrett, Co-Vice-Chair Garrett, and Co-Chairs. Representative Tomei, the best answer I have available is actually located in the bill itself. Page 2, line 16, is what is labeled under that bill as subsection 8A. That details the circumstances under which parties in any circuit court proceeding, which I take to interpret civil or criminal, can request stenographic reporting on their own. The important part would be subsection D. Unless other parties agree to pay all or part of the cost of the report, or the party arranging for the reporting of the proceeding by stenographic means must pay all costs of the reporter. So for the defense, then, that would take authorization from whatever public defender or whoever is paying for it. Ditto for the prosecution. I think as a matter of general practice, it's not really done.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Watt.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Vice-Chair. So we heard some testimony about with a recording and a transcriptionist that you get the actual words, but with a certified court reporter, you get their interpretation of what was said. And that was there was a couple of folks that alluded to that. And I just wonder if you can provide us with some input about whether certified stenographers give the words that are actually spoken or if they interpret them.
I'm not quite sure what that was meant. You know, we're certified reporters, and we strive for accuracy. And we actually will stop proceedings to say, please explain, please slow down. That's the most common one. Slow down or speak up. And the tape recorders can't do that. The electronic reporting can't do that. But I'm kind of baffled with the concept of not being accurate and making an interpretation. We're kind of fussy about the words. That's our job.
No more questions? Okay. Thank you. Three of you.
Thank you.
Karen Icor?
Icor.
Becky Basil? And Jonathan Eames?
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Karen Icorn. I'm a certified shorthand reporter. I'm also a member of the Oregon Court Reporters Association, the Legislative Committee. I am a former Multnomah County court reporter. I was laid off back in 2003 due to budget cutbacks. I've been in the Judicial Department for 14 years. With the loss of approximately 40 official court reporter positions statewide, Oregon's courthouses now rely predominantly on a digital audio system as the official record. Back in the spring of 2008, I was asked by Steve Krasick, he's a Marion County defense attorney, to report an aggravated murder case that he was about to begin in Multnomah County. My services were paid for by the Office of Public Defense Services for that particular trial. I think it was about 3 weeks. All the parties agreed, the prosecutor's office and the defense agreed to that my record would be the official transcript for the proceedings, even though Judge McShane ran the FTR at the same time. And my specific undertaking at that time was to provide daily rough draft transcripts to Steve. And at the end of each day, I gave him a disc. And if he wanted to order final transcripts, he could do that. He was grateful beyond words. Providing these daily transcripts, I felt, was an extraordinarily invaluable service to counsel. It allowed Mr. Krasick to be focused and productive in his trial presentation and quickly review testimony and his notes with specificity. In the end, an accurate appellate record ensured the rights and interests of all concerned individuals were upheld. Multnomah County digitally records every court matter, even when a certified shorthand reporter has been hired by the parties to report a proceeding. Many times these devices have failed to produce an audible recording, and in some instances the tape was not even turned on, missing hours and in some cases full days of proceedings. In one particular instance, when I reported a civil trial, we could hear the radio station coming through the FTR in the courtroom. There's another instance where the digital recording just stopped working, and really the judge stopped the proceedings so an IT person can come up and fix it. Even though I was designated as the official record, they don't really do anything beyond they make sure the tape is working all the time. I have a transcript. Unfortunately, it was not included in my materials. It doesn't have a date or a case name, and it has a lot of unintelligibles from a digital recording transcriber. And I guess what I can say about that is the digital recording is great. It works. It's only as good as the person who's sitting there with the microphone on writing it at, it may be a shorthand reporter writing it down or listening to it and, you know, making a record. It's only as good as that. That's it. And if two people are talking at the same time, if people are not talking loud enough, if they're 3 or 4 feet from the microphones, you don't hear it. And that's what I can say for that. I was going to talk about the two cases that Carol just mentioned, aggravated murder trials. The one that was recorded is being reported by Mary Fagan, and then the one that happened in Bend, but she covered that. Aggravated murder cases are automatically appealed, and I believe it's very essential to have an accurate transcript for the appeals process. Certified shorthand reporters, I believe, provide the most accurate record available, and our judicial economy and efficiency demand an accurate record of all proceedings. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eames, and I'm here on behalf of the National Verbatim Reporters Association. And I hearken back to an earlier hearing when I was testifying before this committee. And I actually felt like I was on the stand a little bit, and I won't name the representative from Grants Press, but who was questioning me during the during the testimony. And he actually said, Mr. Eames, I see you nodding, but for the record, could you please say yes or no? And I think that that's a good example of what can happen during a trial where you don't have someone in the courtroom who is watching what is happening. I'm not going to talk very much, thankfully, I'm sure, for you all about this bill, but I am going to introduce Becky Basil, who is here from South Carolina. She is the president-elect of the National Verbatim Reporters Association and is here to talk about not only the support for the bill, but also the Dash 1 amendments, which could be actually the Dash 2 amendments after some changes are made, which talk about including not only steno reporters in the bill, but also voice writers. I've spoken to many of you about it, but you may still have some questions about what voice writers are. Ms. Basil is going to be testifying to that, so thank you very much.
Co-chair, members of the committee, I thank you for letting me be here to discuss this and to express our support. I can
Excuse
tell.
You need to say your name for the record.
I'm sorry. I'm Becky Basil from South Carolina. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 409 and the Amendment Dash 1 that will include voice writers in the requirement for the court reporters. I arrived in Oregon yesterday, and I get strange looks from people because I don't think they understand everything I'm saying. So if you don't understand me, please stop me because I would like to make sure that I'm heard. Voice writing is not a new method of court reporting. A voice silencer called a stenomask was developed right after World War II. Technology today is there, where we can stand side by side with the steno reporters and provide real time. A professional certified verbatim reporter is actually that, a verbatim reporter, repeating every word that is said, not interpreting what was said. There's the ability of the live court reporter to stop questioning, stop answers that are given if they were not heard, if they need clarification on words. That is not there when you have a recording. And I thoroughly agree with Representative Wand over here. When you're dealing with someone's life and liberty, that's probably the most important thing that the judicial system deals with. As far as voice writing reporters, we are more prevalent in the East Coast. West of the Mississippi, we are beginning to grow in population. We do have certified, nationally certified, voice writers working in the state of Washington and in the state of Oregon, working for federal agencies and federal courts who are working deposition work and are providing real time. That capability is there, and we would like to be recognized as professional court reporters and included in this bill with the reporters. We have a certification system, different levels of certification, very similar to what the stenographic reporters have. We have to pass for the very basic level of certification, the 95% accuracy. The level above that is a 97% accuracy. The speed in each level of testing is comparable to the steno reporters. It's a tad faster because with voice we can perform faster and get testimony faster. There's a requirement for continuing education to make sure that the reporters are up to date with technology. We have in conventions and CE seminars, legal, medical terminology, anything to help the reporter to be prepared to sit there and deal with the different subject matters that come up in the courtrooms and the trials. NVRA takes the stand that the live court reporter in the courtroom is preferable, especially in aggravated murder charges, with making an accurate record and being a true guardian of the record to ensure the rights of not only the defendant but the public with the money that is spent. And I don't know specifically about the state of Oregon, but over the last year there have been many articles that have come out with different trials that had to be retried because of inaccuracies in transcripts when they were reviewed at the appellate level. And when you do this, you're doing a double cost for a trial. And when you get into the aggravated murder, they're looked at more closely because of you're dealing with life and liberty there. Thank you, and I ask you to please support the Amendment-1 to Senate Bill 409.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Hicks.
No, but I will put
all up.
All right, but I will start with Mr. Eames. So, Mr. Eames, there's a couple of aspects to this that I wonder if you could comment on, or for anybody in the panel up here, and that's that the FTR, the recording. You know, I can get that on a disc, burned to disc, before I even leave the courtroom right now. Mm-hmm. And what's nice about that is I can actually, there's a digital directory on there where I can click on cross-examination you know, Jonathan Eames, and I can listen to it at the end of the day as an attorney. And so,
unless I'm shaking my head.
Indeed. Okay. So I'm gonna throw it all out, and then I'll give you a chance to answer it all together. So there's that. I wonder if you could address. Additionally, the judicial assistant now, at least where I come from, is the one who listens to the recording in real time. It's not as though this is just being turned on and then somebody goes about, you know, their business. There's an actual person physically listening to it while it's going on. And I have routinely heard that if the recording is not coming through clearly, then the JA will ask, please speak up, please move the microphone. And so there's that aspect as well. Anyway, yeah. Can you address those two? I mean, I just want to be clear that is currently a capability of the system. I don't see that changing under this proposal.
Well, I can address your first concern. In Multnomah County, it takes 5 days to order a CD. So perhaps Marion County is different, but you have to go down to the clerk's office and put your order in, and they make it, and that's a 5 business day turnaround time. So. That's my understanding of that. And also the few times that I've been in court reporting civil trials the last 8 years, the clerk or the judicial assistant sometimes has the earphones in. Most of the time they do not. They're doing work for the judge. Especially in Multnomah County now, that I think they have to give 10 hours somewhere else. They're working in different parts of the building, so they are not always wired in listening to proceedings. However, there have been plenty of times that I've been there where they've stopped for whatever reason. Something's not working, somebody's not speaking into the microphone. You know, attorneys are walking around the room and they're about 5 or 10 feet from the microphone. So, yes, that has happened in my experience.
Thank you. We're talking about aggravated murder cases here, and so I would hope that that's not the atmosphere the judge is allowing within the courtroom, and I would hope that, technology does exist.
Yeah.
That's the point I wanted. Technology does exist now to where you can get it within minutes, an entire day's audio recording provided to a lawyer from the FTR system. But I won't ask you to further comment on that. But actually, either Ms. Einhorn or Ms. Basil, I would be interested in learning more about the certification system, certified court reporters. Can someone provide to me, either now or later, some statistics, how many certified court reporters there are in Oregon, how certification is obtained, how many certifications have been granted in, say, the past 5 years? I don't know if that information is available readily, but if someone here is able to enlighten us.
Okay. I believe Ms. Studemond later has that information. Okay, can get you that information later. I don't have those numbers on me now.
Thanks.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Co-Chair, may I address that, please? With the voice writers, I do not believe that we have any certified voice writer reporters in the state of Oregon at this point. Simply because I have been told that the voice writers in Oregon have believed to this point that they were not allowed to practice in Oregon because the way your certification system is written, it is written only for steno reporters. And we're hoping that that will change. And I think that if that changes to include voice writers, that you will have certified voice writers.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So, Ms. Basil, so I'm just intrigued with this voice writers repeating word by word,
yes,
what has been stated. How does one do that so quickly when you're hearing what's happening and yet you're repeating it? How can you repeat while you're still hearing?
Thank you for asking that. It is a learning process. You're trying to listen. And I listen for words, and I think that is what most reporters do rather than context of what they're doing, concentrating on words. We're just simply repeating, speaking, where they're listening and typing. It's just a different method. The only difference between the voice writer and the steno reporter is the method of capturing the word. And I'm certified to repeat at 300 words a minute.
Can you hear 300 words a minute? Thank you. Thank you,
difficult.
Mr. Representative Schaffler can contain himself no more.
I cannot, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Up here, it sounds like you're saying ghost writers instead of voice writers.
I understand what she's saying.
Because yesterday... You can transcribe the meeting then. Yesterday there was a legislator, or was it the day before, that he misheard. He thought he was hearing Cattlemen's Association, but he was being asked about Chattlemen's Association. That's an inside joke. That's all I had to say, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Questions?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Last person I have signed up is Gail Meyer.
Thank you, co-chairs, co-vice chair Garrett, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I think I'm going to voluntarily age myself here and point out that I've actually done trials and appeals under five of these different technologies. One is shorthand reporting, then it evolved to stenographer reporting on the machines, then analog tape, then video audio, and then digital. And I have not done, and I don't have any experience with voiceover. But I can tell you that there was, in my experience doing trials and appeals from these proceedings, a marked difference when you went from the shorthand or stenographer reporter to an electronic system, when you pull in completely relied on electronic, and principally for two reasons. One is just manpower in the courtroom. When you went to an electronic system, they had one less person in the courtroom. So the stenographer's sole job was to listen to the record and to take things down. But when you went electronic, that person was removed from the courtroom, and you just had the judge and the clerk there. The clerk had more than one responsibility. And the clerk very frequently was doing paperwork on other cases, talking to other lawyers out in the hallway, doing whatever, coming in and out, but wasn't mindful of what was going on with the record. So frequently, the tape would run out, they wouldn't have flipped the tape, or the equipment wasn't working, or more prominently, the witness wasn't being heard. And so there's just the logistics of the manpower that you've got. You're relying on an individual now who has many responsibilities, and it's not a single responsibility to focus only on the legitimacy of the record. But then secondly, there's so many ways in which an electronic record really doesn't pick up what the witness is saying. If you're shuffling paper, a lot of times you can't hear a word, or if someone coughs in the background, or if someone has slurred speech for some kind of medical condition, you really don't know what it is they're saying. And particularly with aggravated murder cases, there's heavy emotion in very many people's testimony. So there's either witnesses, small young children is what I'm thinking of, who recoil back away from the microphone. They're barely whispering through some of their testimony. Or you have people who are in heavy sobs, and it's convulsive. So if you're just relying upon particularly with the video audio, but if you're just relying on electronic, you really don't get every single word. And in one instance I do recall where an I don't know was transcribed as a no because the words I don't wasn't heard. So this can be very consequential. The thing that's important about aggravated murder trials is appellate review is a certainty. It is a certainty. It's mandated by Oregon law. You will have an appeal from an aggravated murder trial. So these trials go on for years. They're very complicated. There's a lot of scientific testimony, forensic evidence, medical conditions, a lot of foreign words. And if there's not a good record, then it takes the trial lawyer who has to correct the record. And so that's $90 an hour through the OPDS system. You're asking the trial lawyer at $90 an hour to correct the record. And then it goes up on appeal from there. I do note, in comparison to other systems, I'm thinking of Representative Wan's comments, in federal court, they do have a court reporter there, and they also have both. They have both. They have audio and stenographer. And I note that they do that in the civil law, too. When civil lawyers have a deposition, they call in a court reporter. They don't turn on a tape recorder. The court reporter brings the tape recorder, but the lawyers bring the stenographer. So we support Senate Bill 409. In terms of costs, I think it could be tailored more specifically to things that are significant on appellate review, the trial, evidentiary rulings, certain pretrial proceedings that are case dispositive, but there are some pretrial proceedings relating to an aggravated murder trial that are not consequential on appeal, so maybe there's some tailoring that could be done. Thank you.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Representative Garrett. Ms. Meyer, this is tagged with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And, I mean, the reason for that is, to be blunt, I mean, we're talking about a cost shift of some indeterminate amount, probably rather substantial, or it has the potential to be rather substantial, from the public defense budget to the courts. I mean, that's what's really at stake here for the government, what we're looking at. You know, and it's not going to be optional. It's not going to be within judicial discretion anymore. It's the courts being on the tag for it. And so before we really go there, I want to know, do you have any record of any instances, we're talking strictly ag murder, you know, any instances where, one, there hasn't been a court reporter in the courtroom, and two, due to the absence of a court reporter, there's been some material effect on the appellate process. Do we have any examples before we go making this step?
Yeah, thank you. Co-chairs and members of the committee, Representative Hicks, I had hoped I could have snagged one of my lawyers to come on in and say, to answer that question expressly. What I am told is that there are instances of delay where the lawyers have to spend a long time correcting the record, that the transcription of the electronic recording of an aggravated murder trial is such that there are unintelligible spots. And the trial lawyer then has to go back and, in consultation with the district attorney, who is the trial lawyer also, and the judge, try and correct that record. And I think the parties walk away with different levels of assurance that the agreed record is accurate. So that's my answer to your question. And if you need, what I'd like to do perhaps is see if we couldn't get someone to perhaps give you an express call who could actually give that answer to you in greater detail. Yeah.
Follow up?
Yeah, I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I mean, but that's the kind of information we're going to want to know. And in regards to the record, I mean, if it is in fact unintelligible, if the answer is in fact unintelligible, I mean, we want to know that too. And the audio recording is arguably pretty well suited, perhaps even superiorly suited, better suited to tell us that. I mean, that's information you'd want to know if you're taking a case, I would think, to an appellate court. If the witness's answer was unintelligible, that's important to know too. So. There's more to it. There's another dimension to it than that. That's what I'm submitting.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Co-chairs and Vice Chair Hicks, the problem with the electronic recording is that I don't know on a present moment basis that you know that the recording is unintelligible. You won't know that till the end of the day, and the child witness is off the stand. And so that's the problem. The problem is you don't have present moment ability to really say, slow down, repeat that, I can't hear you, whatever. It's just being recorded, and then the witnesses leave, and you go home with the recording, and it becomes unintelligible. That's the problem.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just in response to Representative Hicks, another reason why they get an unintelligible or an indiscernible is because of the poor quality of the recording equipment. And the reason why I asked the question about the federal courthouse, the reason why I asked the question about the federal courthouse is because it's a brand new building with brand new state-of-the-art recording technology. They have courtrooms that are shaped properly so there's no dead zones, and you can walk around and you can raise the volume of your voice up or down, you can speed up or slow down, and they are going to pick up everything. That's not the situation with our circuit courts. It just isn't. And in Multnomah County, there are courtrooms where you cannot walk in certain places, no matter how loud you are, and I've done it, because it won't pick you up. And on a in a civil case, when you're going up on an appeal, there's a whole process for the lawyers to go back and forth 15 times to talk about what that undiscernible section talked about, but the stakes are different. And So those are that's the reason why I asked those questions. So just wanted to toss that out for the committee. Thanks.
Further questions? Seeing none. Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 409 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 396.
Co-chairs, Senate Bill 396 modifies the rules which govern the circumstances under which a sheriff may serve a copy of a protected order. Presently, they are not allowed to serve a copy of a protective order if it is received by electronic mail. This bill would permit that. It would also allow less restrictive restraining orders to be served by mail in lieu of in person. It allows a sheriff to enter return of service of that warrant into the Law Enforcement Database Service, or LEDS, without waiting for a formal affidavit of service, which is helpful if there's no one available to enter that in. It also clarifies the rules that govern what a peace officer should do and how long they should remain when they are accompanying a restrained person to their household in order to allow that person to gather their personal effects before they become restrained from the premises. It specifies that only 20 minutes will be allocated for that purpose, and it will only be permitted to happen once. The bill would also grant the peace officer civil and criminal immunity from all liability committed by the restrained person during the gathering of their effects.
Okay, we have two people sign up to testify, Brian Wallace and Marshall Ross.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Marshall Ross. I'm a senior deputy with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Senate Bill 396 is helps sheriff with improvements in obtaining protective orders and in getting returns of service from police officers so that we can serve protective orders faster, get them entered into LEDS faster, thereby serving the victims of domestic violence, abuse, and stalking. Much of this is due to innovations in technology. A few sessions ago, we came to you and obtained law that allowed us to serve facsimiles of protective orders. That has worked wonderfully in especially in the metro area where abusers and crooks don't respond to jurisdictional lines and stay within our counties. I'm able to fax it over to another sheriff when we're pursuing someone and they have a known whereabouts outside the county. This will allow us to not only use it by facsimile, but also recognizing that we could email it to each other and getting a better readable copy. Another aspect of this bill is it will allow city police officers to fax us their return of service so that we can immediately enter it into the LED system. This will keep cops on the street, especially in small jurisdictions where there may only be one police officer on a graveyard shift. Currently, they have to leave their jurisdiction unprotected, travel to the sheriff's office, fill out a proof of service, which leaves their community unprotected for just purely a paperwork issue. This would allow them to fax over their return of service and stay on patrol. We also have a little technical fix in here regarding how a request for a modification to a restraining order is served. Currently, it says we shall serve it as a summons, but then it says we shall serve it personally, which service of a summons can be in a variety of methods. This clarifies that it has to be personally served. We've also got a section in here dealing with modifications of a restraining order that a petitioner obtains that loosens or changes visitation, what the court in the law terms an order of less restriction. This would allow us to serve it by simply mailing a copy without the need to actually go out, find the respondent, and personally serve it. There's actually a catch-22 that exists currently when a petitioner goes in and gets an order that says respondent can now attend church or attend counseling. The parties start abiding by that immediately. They don't wait for the sheriff to physically go out and personally serve the respondent. orders of this nature are mandatory arrest. So we have a period of time where I have had cases where a respondent has been arrested for doing something which legally he is entitled to do, but hasn't been served with a copy of the order yet. This would eliminate that issue. Any modification of the order that changes the order that is not a petition of less restrictions by the petitioner still needs to be personally served. We need to do that so that we can tie any successful prosecution to a violation to that personal service, so that we can prove that the respondent had actual notice. We've also got a section in here where we are dealing with a standby provision on juvenile court restraining orders. We've taken the language straight out of the Family Abuse Prevention Act and putting it into the juvenile court protective order section. We're not reinventing the wheel here. This is a section that guides police officers as to their responsibility and their legal abilities when they are conducting a standby pursuant to these types of orders. It's now missing in the juvenile court orders. This will add to the juvenile court orders to assist the police, the sheriffs, and respondents in understanding what's going to happen when we're on scene and removing somebody pursuant to a juvenile court order.
Co-Chairs Barker and Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Brian Wallace. I'm the Chief Civil Supervisor at the Marion County Sheriff's Office and President of the Oregon Sheriff's Civil Command Council. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 396A. The reason I'm talking so fast is because I'm late to a National Honor Society for middle school, and I need to talk to them about stenography, I mean criminal justice, and how important that is. So I'll be real quick. I just echo everything that he says. This is a really good bill. It's not very sexy, but it's good for all parties. It streamlines processes. It doesn't infringe on anybody's due process rights. It's been blessed by the Oregon Law Center. We've been working in conjunction with them to make sure that everything is squared away as far as the modification process and how those modifications are served. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Mike Shoffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, it's not too sexy now. Confiscating passports, now that's sexy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I want to know what he does in his free time. Now I'm going to go a little far afield here. I know if you have to run, then I won't be offended. But while we're on the subject of Section 7, Paragraph D, 1D, which is the 20 minutes peace officer may temporarily go in. Sounds fine. I mean, 20 minutes, I expect you can do it in that amount of time. If you could, one, comment on how you got to that point, but two, this is an interesting question because it contemplates the peace officer's duty to arrest. And so tracing that back a bit, it's because I think the peace officer would, during the course of that presence in the household, see some or gain reasonable suspicion of a crime having occurred. And I'm wondering, maybe counsel can even extrapolate on this and if it's appropriate to add language to this effect. Now, do we have consent to search? Because the court has ordered the peace officer to accompany the restrained person. Okay. You get where I'm going with that? And so now the peace officer has, in this language, authority to arrest based presumably upon reasonable suspicion he gained from seeing something in the house. I mean, I'm turning up a little bit here, but I'd like us to ponder this a little bit more, I guess. You all are free to comment on this, but I know I've got him spun up here. So. But that's one thing I just want to make sure we are tight on that point before we move it out of the building.
Counsel, please opine. Yes, very briefly, Co-Chair Garrett. My understanding on this, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that a person to be restrained would have had prior notice via the service of the restraining order before the actual return to the house and gathering of the possessions. So, they would have had time, so to speak, to hide the stash or have the stash from the moment of service.
Yes, they're restrained from the house. They're not.
Do you guys have an answer on this one?
Co-chairs, Representative Hicks, this only authorizes officers to stand by. It does not give us any authority to even enter. Under the Family Abuse Prevention Act, we go and we knock on the door, but if the petitioner inside won't allow us to enter for the respondent to have their 20-minute standby, we're done. We walk away. It's up to the respondent at that time to go up to court and get an order for the sheriff to enter a specific address for the purpose of retrieving personal property. You're correct. These are not search and seizure orders. These just authorize and direct an officer to stand by while the respondent removes their things. The authority to arrest exists that it's still, we are bringing, under the FAPA, we are bringing adverse parties together, a petitioner and a respondent. It allows an officer to still arrest that respondent for any violation of the order. Okay. My professional record is 11 seconds when he said, bitch, you're dead. We still have the authority, even though we're there and he has the right to come with us, excuse me for being gender specific, but 95% of it is that way, we're still able to protect the victim from threats, abuse that may occur.
Okay, I'm here. Okay. I'd like us to delve into that a little bit, though. If we need to make an amendment, if it's appropriate under this particular statute, then we're gonna look at it even so on our potentially on our end for that, because I don't want this to come back in 2 years from some strange circumstance in which police officer goes in with respondent under court order, sees marijuana, arrests respondent, now we're in court, judge doesn't know what to do because the legislature gave him this law. So that's that, and if we can clarify that right now, I think that we'll all be better off in the long run. I hear the situation you're trying to address, which is just the one you described. I mean, a violation of the restraining order specifically. The language of the law doesn't, I'm not seeing a limitation to strictly under the terms of the restraining order would prohibit an arrest, and that would be inappropriate anyway to simply say if you see a crime, let it go because you're only there because of the restraining order. I mean, that's not how law enforcement works. So I think perhaps he and I will talk, and then we can touch base again subsequently. Thank you.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, it's just getting sexier all the time now.
Yeah. The closed public hearing on Senate Bill 396. No further business here.